So the subject is, what is it that pulls me, us, towards awakening? What is it that works in us, that brings us here? And some kind of reflection on where this place is in us, or out of us. The Buddha once wrote, well, we don't know what really happened to Gautama Buddha in his life, but according to the tradition, after years of intensive, super effort and discipline, he was still stuck. In some way, he was still in the world of too much pushing, striving, struggling, and there was something stuck. And he wrote, in his own words, that he wrote in his own words, so-called, that then he suddenly remembered that when he was a young boy, he had the experience of awakening while sitting under a tree, while his father, who was in charge of the fields, was busy with the agriculture. And he was sitting under the tree and he had an experience of, you might call, unity. Or interbeing, or totality. And it was the remembering that experience that kind of gave him the next stage, or the next push. Meaning that there was something natural about awakening, that he realized he didn't have to work so desperately hard to get something there, because it was already something here that was, in a way, in his childhood experience. That puts the whole thing in a very different light. To keep the elephants out. It puts it in a very different light. We were all children. We all had experiences, I think, of great freedom as children. And we all pushed them aside and became adults. Serious, dedicated, busy, trying hard for things, trying to fix the problems of our childhood. What is it, that free place in us, the place of awakening is mostly defined by what it's not. Even some very fundamental words like unconditioned are negative words. They point to what awakening is not. And so, when we think about awakening and we think about the movement in us for awakening, then it is a movement of something that we don't want. It's a movement of removing something that is, in a way, imprisoning us, rather than getting something which we're not sure what it is. What is it that we want to remove? But what is it that we want to reveal? So, I must say, in the introduction to this, that firstly, I shouldn't use the word awakening, but I should use the word awakenings. because it's really not at all defined in one kind of consistent way by anybody in anywhere. You will find the huge variety of people who are not awakened, ki'ilu not awakened, talking about it in 100 different ways, and people after so-called awakening talking about it in 100 different ways. So there isn't an awakening. We can already get rid of that kind of pestle, that statue, that icon called a state, called awakening, which we all want to move towards. Their awakenings. And talking about it is quite difficult, and partly because we have so many fixations, associations, desires, longings around it. And those are actually the good things we have. But it's still, talking about it makes vibrations. So just let them be where they are, whatever, however it hits you is good enough. But just to be aware that it does create a kind of a sense of a place, just the using language about it creates a sense of a place and a place beyond, and a place that's not here, but somewhere else. And in the language, you know, of the Buddha too, the Buddha said, for example, there is an island beyond, which is an island where a safe place beyond the stormy seas of samsara. And so there is this kind of echo called awakening as beyond. And it does echo in us. And that's the risk of talking about it. The risk of using language. But we'll take that risk, because there's another risk of not using that language. Which is, in a way, it makes it worse. Then it's just the elephant in the room that no one wants to see. And we're all busy with trying to find an elephant, but no one wants to talk about it, or no one wants to see it. So I think, in a way, not talking about it is even more problematic than talking about it. It does create a sense of goal, a sense of success or failure. It does make those echoes in our consciousness, in our mind, when we hear it, when we read about it, when we think about it. And also, it's scary. Because in a way, we'd rather have the self we know and be safe than something so unknown and possibly scary as going beyond the self that we know. So there is a certain amount of fear around that. I'd rather have the me that I know, not the some like imagination that the awakening is like an abyss, because they're tehom, that I fall inside. And so there is a certain insecurity around that. We might not really be who we think we are. That's a fascinating thought, but a scary one. We might not actually be who we think we are. We all want to be somewhere in a perfect place, but it might be not who we are. So, but that's the only me that I know. So that, what do I do with this me that I know? Do I have to drop it? And some of you have been discussing this in the groups and so on. Even in this, that language, of it's a bit scary, this whole thing. So that's another kind of risk, in a way. We are afraid of not being. And I think it's fair enough, because we need a solid self to begin any journey. To begin any journey, the basic equipment is to be okay with ourselves. Whether it's a journey across from Rakevet Yisrael from Kliel to Tel Aviv, or it's a journey of 1,000 miles, or if it's a journey, a spiritual journey that takes our whole life. We have to start with good equipment, and the good equipment is a sense of being okay with myself, in myself. There is an Indian story that the spiritual journey, the spiritual transformation, is like ants that eating a lump of sugar. And we all think, well, the sugar is the spiritual goodies, the sweetness that comes from our spiritual life. And the spirit, and we are the ants eating the sugar of spirituality. But the truth is exactly the opposite. We are the sugar. That's the story. That's the Indian metaphor. We are the sugar. The ants are indeed the spiritual experiences, and they eat us until we're gone. So maybe we'd rather stay as the sugar. And there's a tendency to make all of this very big or very small. There's a tendency in thousands of years to turn awakening into this incredible beyond, which takes hundreds of lifetimes of repeated visits into bodies, recycling bodies, life after life after life, in order to arrive at awakening. Or there's a tendency to make it very small, sort of be comfortable with it. The awakening is more like feeling comfortable. I'm feeling a kind of a big person and at ease and comfortable and peaceful and quiet, and that's awakening. There is tendencies to go in either direction, to make it very big or make it very small. But I want to kind of bring it back to what I would call something very natural. And I think it's in the Four Noble Truths, because it's always been, it's something that, you know, I'm surprised that I don't hear a lot about this. Maybe it's a personal view. But the third noble truth is the truth of the ending of suffering, the truth of awakening. If it's one of the four noble truths, it means it's a truth. It doesn't mean it's an unattainable state beyond our universe. It means it's a truth like the first and the second and the third and the fourth and the fourth. Means that there is such a thing, and it is a truth that's in the nature of our world. It is a possibility. Like the first truth is the truth of suffering. That is, suffering is within our experience as an embodied being, that we cannot escape it. Should we say, isipuk, unsatisfaction is inescapable. Well, that's a truth we all know. Why not the third truth being just same as that? That awakening is inescapable. Why not? It is a truth, after all. And if we trust the Buddha, and I certainly do, his insight, then we have to look again at the third truth and say, yeah, it's a real truth. It's not an unattainable and impossible place. So I would put that in the category of something there, something natural. And, you know, the word Nibbana is perhaps the most well-known word for it in the Pali, Nirvana in Sanskrit. And it just simply means, like I said the other day, cooling down. Putting out the fires of craving, of needing, of processing, of unsatisfaction, of busyness, of ambition, of trying to get this and trying to get that, and never enough, and protection, and fighting, and conflict, and papancha, and the whole mess. It's quietening all of that down into a deep peace where the fires don't burn anymore. The fires have gone out. but it needs to be part of things. It can't be, as I say, somewhere else completely. It needs to be part of the way things are. And here I think we can look at moments in our own childhood or in our own experience, in our daily practice and in our, especially in retreats, and say that moment is a genuine moment of awakening. The problem is, it may not last. That's the only problem. If we could maintain it, we would say, I'm awakened person. No such thing as awakened person. Just impossible, but never mind. We'll talk about that later. But we can say, yes, there is a suffering moment, and there is a moment of awakening to what is, awakening to the sense of total belonging, me and the world as together, awakening of the sense of the bigness of things, awakening to the sense of deep peace. And these are precious moments, and they are, and they can be totally unconditioned. But at those moments, no conditions. There's no conditions are happening. There is that sense of completeness, of completeness. Awakening has to be something very close, not far away. Many teachers say that it's closer than our own thoughts. Thank goodness. Because our thoughts give us hell. So it's got to be closer than them. They are like bugging us all the time. So awakening is clearly not another one of them. But if in a sense it's a deep truth, then it's closer than our thoughts. Close to us. It's hidden inside. It's where we really are, covered over by all the conditions of samsara. The issues, the difficulties, the childhood difficulties that we experience, the pains and limitations and the scars of the world, the sankharas, the formations, the struggles and so on. They're covered over. And we can feel that maybe the truth says, the third noble truth says, the place of perfection in us, shlemut, is never lost. It's always there, but it's just more or less covered over by selfing and by forms, by an automatic kind of living. And so this gives it another perspective. The Buddha didn't really call this the awakening a state beyond. In some ways he did, but he kept saying it's actually simply the end of suffering, meaning it's the ending of all that stuff. It's not a special state beyond, although he did use that language as well, like the island, but we don't know how much that's metaphor and picture and image and how much it's not. But when he talked about awake, simply said, all I teach is the ending of suffering. It really means the ending of all the stuff that bugs us. Then awakening is emerging by itself. That it's not something that we need to pull out from some with real hard, intensive work to try and pull it out or catch it from some other place, like cosmic consciousness waiting for it to land. No, it's there, but just covered. So there's a sense that we need to kind of, like Rumi says, how do you dig a well? You just keep digging and throwing away everything that's not water. So there's something there when in this description of awakening as the ending of suffering, which is simply digging the well and throwing away everything that's not water. And then the water appears. The water is there. Their water is there from the beginning. So that's a slightly different picture. And if it's there from the beginning, it can emerge in different ways. It can have voices in us that we don't respect, we don't notice. Maybe they're small, maybe they're little, maybe they pass by. We can't catch them. But this must have a voice in us, this awakening. one of the problems with this voice of awakening is that it isn't in the territory of description. Although the Buddha used so many words, and so do we, and as I said, mostly they're negative words, like unconditioned, unlimited, beyond boundaries, beyond pain and suffering, etc. So it refers to what is, what we know as our conditioned life or conditioned experience, and then saying it's not that. And the reason is that we don't really have words, because words themselves come from a place of conditioning. We learn that, you know, you all grow up as children and learn Hebrew, I grew up as a child and learn English. That's the nature of things. I won't go into the obvious conditioning problem I have. But it's learnt. Language is a form. A thought is a form. A thought is suffering. It's a form. It's like packaging the universe into a bottle. Or pouring the sea, the ocean, into a bottle. It's a form. So awakening can't be there, because that's the conditioned forms that we struggle with. Language is one of them too. So we can use language, we can describe it, we can point to it, but we can't package awakening. By definition, it isn't packageable into the forms of learnt samsara or sankharas, formations. It's not packageable. So there's a problem there. One of the most beautiful texts, and I hope, Rennie, you don't mind me relating what happened when I showed you the text the other night, because there was tears in Rennie's eyes when I showed her this text from the Buddha, and there's tears in my eyes when I read it too, just because of it, so profound and so beautiful, and it's from the Sutta Nipata, which is probably the earliest text, and it's quite short. The pieces are quite short. So someone asks the Buddha, what happens? How do you recognize an awakened person? What happens to them? And he answers, it is like a flame that is struck by a sudden gust of wind, said the Buddha. In a flash, it has gone out, and nothing more can be known about it. It's the same with a wise man freed from mental content. In a flash, he has gone out, and nothing more can be known about him. And the person asking, Upasiva, clearly didn't quite understand, and it's not so easy to understand. He said, please explain this clearly to me. He said, Upasiva, you, a wise man, saying to the Buddha, know precisely the way these things work. Has the man disappeared? Does he simply not exist? Or is he in some ultimate state of forever well-being? And the Buddha answered, when a person has gone out, then there is nothing by which you can measure him or her. That by which he can be talked about is no longer there for him. You cannot say that he does not exist. When all ways of being, all phenomena are removed, then all ways of description have also been removed. So it's simply undescribable or unfindable. The person that is awakened is not findable. You can't put a label anymore, because the category of labeling, description, processing, normal processing that our mind is used to, is a conditioned processing, and it doesn't fit the unconditioned. It just can't get there. So it can point to it, but it can't get there because the awakening isn't in that territory of forms which, as I say, give us trouble. But the seeds have to be in us already. So what are these seeds? There is a very big story in the Mahayana tradition of the Buddha nature. And the Buddha nature is kind of potential that we have. But there is a huge dispute about what that is. And it gets people from the Vipassana or Theravada tradition very cross. And I understand why. Because the Theravada tradition really doesn't go there. The Theravada tradition doesn't like that. Because the Theravada tradition is based on the early Buddhist teaching, takes as authority the early Buddhist texts. And the early Buddhist texts and the Buddhist teachings, which in a way have come through a rather direct lineage through Thailand, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, who are all, in a way, tracing their roots back to the early Buddhist teaching, which is developed, but it still has that authority. And there's nothing there in the early Buddhist teaching about Buddha nature. And on the contrary, it's rather against what the Buddha was talking about. Because the Buddha nature implies something. And it's exactly what the Buddha was teaching against all his life. There is no something called an awakened thing. There's no something called a person. The whole issue of things is back to conditioned samsara. So the Buddha nature is to some extent a real no-no to people in the Theravada world. But I think that also is a little bit not understanding Buddha nature enough. Because when you really look at the... I was interested in this, like, one time a few years ago, I was in India. I spent 3 weeks in a certain center, and I did nothing else but read this huge, difficult, complicated book on Buddha nature. Just this big, and the language, English book, but the language was like, you know, the worst British philosophers that you can think of. Anyway, at the end of that, I kind of understood that the whole thing is very open and that there's no agreement what is Buddha nature, and that there is a lot of indication that I think in that word, the way it's used in the Tibetan, especially, tradition, which actually the Buddha wouldn't have such a problem with. Because it really talks in the language of our potential for awakening, that we have this potential. In fact, the most key word in the Tibetan for Buddha nature is garb, which means womb. Womb, rechem. And a rechem is empty. So clearly the Buddha wouldn't have a problem with that. It's empty. But it's an empty space out of which comes life. And so the womb, the Buddha nature as a womb, is the space in us out of which comes awakening. The potential that we have for awakening, the potential that we have in us. And also the fact that we, potential that we have in our awareness to push ourselves to awakening. To push or to be pulled. Kind of subtle difference, but an important one. But we have it. Otherwise nobody would ever be awakened. So there is a potential in our consciousness itself. And as I say, it's part of the consciousness. In some way or other, it has to be natural. Like the Buddha talked about his child, his experience as a child. And there's a lot of parts of us that we don't value so much, which could be there, but we don't notice it because we're busy with forms. For example, our ability to hold the unknown, iyadhya, not knowing. Our ability to stand in the middle of paradox and say, I am in the middle of the unsolvable, that my mind cannot go there. And actually some of you have said this in this retreat, because we've been talking about selfing and trying to understand, for the self to understand the self, there is potential for huge paradox, confusion, doubt, and sort of, like I say, the trapeze, they're holding on to the trapeze, which is flying through the air in the kirkus, the circus, and you leave one trapeze, you don't get to the next, right? So you lose the sense of me, security, me, and you don't quite get to the next one, and you're in space, and it's. So we have that capacity, we have those experiences, we have that ability to stand in the middle of paradox. Impossible puzzles, impossible riddles that don't give us a place to stand, that don't give us safety. We can be there, and we do go there. And as a child, I think we go there all the time. As a child, I think we're constantly on the edge of the unknown. And play is there. Play is about the known and the unknown. When we become adults, then we forget. We forget the, in a way, beauty and the magic of being on the edge all the time of the unknown. And that's why as a child we often think adults have really lost it. They're really poor adults. At least that's what I thought as a child. I looked around me and think, oh, poor adults, I hope I don't get to be one of them. Nagarjuna was certainly by Nagarjuna's time, the 4th century, several hundred years after the death of the Buddha, Buddha nature was a theme. And he wrote a lot about it, and I know these poems are difficult, so I won't read the whole poem. They're kind of themselves, these poems are paradoxical. And he wrote them like that. He wrote these poems in order for kind of the bottom to fall out of our world, to kind of collapse our world. He said, for example, about Buddha nature, he said, it's not physical, emotional, conceptual, conscious, it's not in will or impulse, it's not in anything else. It does not dwell in us, nor we in it. It does not own us. If it depended on us, or on anything else, it would not be itself. But how can it be anything except itself? Could what is not itself be Buddha nature? Can you say that Buddha nature is empty, when empty and not empty are just words? Believers believe in Buddhas who vanish in nirvana. Don't imagine empty Buddhas, vanishing or not. Buddha nature is the nature of this world. Buddha nature has no nature, nor does this world. It just gives a sense that the insight that Buddha nature, yes, there is in us a place of potential, the womb, but it's not in the world of constructions. And we need to look somewhere else for it. And I think that that helps us to understand that the practice is a lot more about what we drop, what we peel off, what we leave behind. When we go out of this retreat, this room here is the biggest pachashpa. ...20-meter-long pachashpa of all the stuff we left behind, hopefully. What we peel off, what we leave behind, is more important. And the more we unpeel, the more something in us, which is quite mysterious, quite unclear now, might appear, might emerge, might shine. Another place where we can kind of appreciate the awakening in us, or the Buddha nature, is longing. Longing, kamiha. It's a place that we all recognize. But if there was nowhere to go, then there would be no longing for anything. The longing tells us we are, in a way, wanting to come back home. The longing is also the Buddha nature. It is telling us there is a place that we can dimly see, or that we can dimly remember, that is pulling us. And we may not know what it is. We probably don't know what it is. But the longing itself, the fact that we feel that life cannot be just this. It cannot be just this. There has to be something beyond or perfect. If there is imperfection, it's only because we have a concept of perfection. We have a concept of perfection, and that creates longing. If we didn't have a concept of perfection, we wouldn't know imperfection. So, something in us, and that is the Buddha nature, and that is the Buddha within. With that, we can take refuge in those places. We can have faith in those places. We can have faith in our potential. We can have faith in a place in us which, in the image, is like a golden statue which is covered in mud. Or a jewel in the lotus, or a jewel in the bottom of a pond, or the water in the well that we have to dig and throw away the earth until we find it. And I think another place that we can also see in us, which is our Buddha nature, is the sense of dukkha, the sense that we understand pain. They often say that the animal realm, the difference between humans and animals, is that we can reflect on pain and pleasure. And animals have no ability to reflect. They don't know there is pain and pleasure. They just are in pain or in pleasure. I'm not so sure about that myself. That's the kind of perceived wisdom, but when I look at my dog, I think he knows quite a lot about what's good for him, what's not good for him, painful, pleasurable experiences. I wouldn't, but, you know, leave that aside. But there is something painful about the fact that we're in the wheel of samsara, and it seems hard work. And that makes us feel maybe there isn't all this work to be done. It feels like hard work to sustain our bodies, to sustain our life, to keep us going. It feels like we really have to work to sustain something which is uncomfortable for us. That's kind of a paradox which can wake us up. Why are we working so hard to sustain samsara? Struggle, conflict, disease, you know, neediness, hungry. After 10 minutes, after one meal, I'm already feeling I need something else. Why? What's going on? Why are we just, this is hard work. There's something there that doesn't fit right, feel right. So we have an intuition about that. And that's another manifestation of the Buddha nature, I think, the so-called Buddha nature. So we want to step off the wheel of samsara. We want to cool down, cool it all down. We want to reduce clinging and craving and needing. We want to kind of reduce the fuel. Upadana attachment is fueling the fire. So we want to take away the fuel, the delek, from the fires, and let it all settle down. And that is Dharma. That is Dharma. The Dharma is that place of continually starving the fires of fuel. We don't do it aggressively. We don't do it, we don't try and blow out the fires. We just don't feed them. And that's a gentle process, a gentler process. And sometimes attachment is used in a very negative way and it makes a lot of confusion. And it's as if we're all addicted to heroin or cigarettes. And we have to fight it and grit our teeth and get out of this addiction. But it's actually rather softer than that. It's just we just stop feeding the fire and cool down, settle down, cool the fire. The one issue that makes this whole thing problematic is that we can't ever say that awakening belongs to anybody. Because the self, as we've been talking about for a whole week, is itself a conditioned reaction. So it's another bottle in which we pour the ocean. It's a form. The self is a form. So we cannot say that awakening belongs to anybody or belongs to me. We can say that I am a vessel in which awakening can be developed. But awakening itself doesn't belong to anybody. That's the same language that the Buddha was saying, it just doesn't work anymore. That language of belonging, of description, of mine, of the definitions. Let me read Krishnamurti, because I love the way he describes his awakened experiences. And you can get the feeling here that it's not doesn't belong to him or to anybody. In the silence of deep night and in the quiet, still morning, when the sun is touching the hills, there is a great mystery. It is there in all living things. If you sit quietly under a tree, you would feel the ancient earth with its incomprehensible mystery. Incomprehensible, you cannot understand it. On a still night, when the stars are clear and close, you would be aware of expanding space and the mysterious order of all things, of the immeasurable and of nothing, of the movement of the dark hills and the hoot of an owl. In that utter silence of the mind, this mystery expands without time and space. Experience is the death of that incommunicable mystery. To be in communion with that, the mind, the whole of you, must be at the same level, at the same time, with the same intensity as that which is called mysterious. And this is love. With this, the whole mystery of the universe is opened. So it's clearly not an experience, and it doesn't belong to anybody, and it can't be defined. It's in the realm of not knowing, of mystery, of not being able to hold it with any concept. And it is more like love, which is unmeasurable. You can't say that we measure love, or we can contain love, or we can hold it. It's not a, love is not, itself is not a concept. Feels more like love, but it's not a concept because our consciousness becomes it. It's not that we experience it, we become it. That's something a bit different. The consciousness is it, not experiencing it. In our practice, in our spiritual practice, in the Dharma practice, we move perhaps from ordinary experiences, we move to places where we have realizations, discoveries, understandings, things begin to drop away, things become less painful or less closing us. We feel a relative reduction in suffering. Our suffering is, or isipuk, is less. We become more connected with life. We become more at ease. And this is, I think, the place where many of us are on the journey. And it's not yet the place of ultimacy, ultimacy, how would you say it? Same word? How would you say in Hebrew ultimacy? Mukhlat. Mukhlat. It's not yet, but this is a blessing, a blessed place to be. And it will, staying in that place will be the best thing we can do. We can't force awakening, but we can stay in that place of, like I say, insight, much less suffering and difficulty, openness, connectedness, an open heart, and drops of awakening dropped in, drop by drop by drop, not in our hands. We can't control it, we can't measure it, we can't make it faster, we can't design it. It's just, that's the mental construction. We just can't force any of it. But from that place, we gradually realize that all the qualities that we have as a person, and some of the qualities are very much blessed, like the paramitas, that means higher qualities of calm, of love, of steadiness, of insight, of wisdom, of joy, and blessed qualities. They're still in the level of the person. So when there is awakening drop by drop, sometimes it becomes big time, but mostly it's drop by drop, those qualities of the personality, which are positive qualities, they become the expressions. They are both the source and the expression. So it's not that we leave behind, we become a kind of a cloud or an angel sitting in a cloud. We are still a human being. We still have those qualities. They still manifest in us. But before they are practice, and after they're just the expression, natural expression, they're still there. Our personality before becomes the place we work with, after it just becomes an expression. It just becomes a natural expression. It has no problem in it. So it's kind of, it's not that we disappear, we go off somewhere, it's not that that it vanishes. Like he said, like the Buddha said, it's not that the person doesn't exist. It's just that you can't measure them by normal measurements, normal categories. And I want to finish with that because it's really important, and it's something I just mentioned in the Dana talk today, that the way we act and the way we are is part of, inherent part of all of that process. It is not just something that happens to consciousness. So as if we sit in a cave for 20 years, we're bound to get there. It is about the way we interact, because there's no difference between knowing and acting. Therefore, the practice and also the realization has to be in the knowing as well as in the acting. There isn't any difference between mind, speech, and action. They are all part of interaction with this being and the universe. So that's why it's really important, and we, you know, there's a slightly artificial situation that we're here to meditate, and meditation is the thing we're doing, but it's wise not to forget that in the basic Buddhist tradition, meditation is just part of a group of practices which are as much to do with action, words, thought, echoes, vibration with the world, love, empathy, all of that, as sitting in meditation. We gave it priority in this retreat, and in the Western world there's quite a lot of priority. In the East it's less, so there is less priority of meditation. Doesn't matter, it's fine to have priority somewhere. But just to remember that they are equal, and that action, conduct, the way we are in the world, is as much a practice as the way we meditate and what happens to our consciousness. And it's interesting, I've got a quote here from William Blake to finish. And he says, probably you know, it's one of his most famous quotations. He says, he's talking about the enlightened, basically enlightened state, and his beautiful language. He says, it is to see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower, to hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. That's very famous, but then he goes on to say, which people don't know, but I think it's just as important, and in the same poem he says, a robin redbreast, what's the Hebrew robin? Adam chazeh, a bird, small bird. A robin redbreast in a cage puts the whole of heaven in a rage. In other words, that's the next bit in the same poem where he talks about infinity, and then he says, but, you know, what is it you're doing? So I just want to finish with that as a kind of a message to not to forget. Thank you.